Hi, this is Andrew.
And this is Amy, and in this episode, AADL talks to photographer and activist Lenny Sinclair.
Lenny recalls the origins of the Detroit Artists Workshop and the first trans love commune in Detroit, and their strategic retreat to Ann Arbor following the Detroit riots. She also talks about the group's politicization as the White Panther Party and reflects on life at the Hill Street commune, including what led to its breakup in the mid-1970s.
Why did you come to America?
To live in a country that had democracy and jazz.
And then what brought you to Detroit when you came to the United States? Is this where you – did you intend to come to Detroit originally when you were coming to the United States?
Well, I had no choice. I had relatives in Detroit who were my sponsors, and that's where I had to be. I had an aunt and several cousins that lived here already, and they took me in when I first came here and kind of watched over me and helped me get jobs.
You met John in 1964, I think I read, and you were interested in shooting photographs of jazz musicians prior to getting involved with shooting rock musicians. What brought you to photography of musicians in general?
Well, I did think when I came to America that there would be jazz on every street corner, and so but that wasn't why I took pictures. I got a camera before I left East Germany just to have a camera to shoot snapshots, you know, me at the Empire State Building or me at the Grand Canyon, and then send them home, you know. And so when I met John Sinclair, he was the Detroit correspondent for Downbeat magazine. And so when we became friends, I started hanging out, going to clubs with him, which prior I had no access when I first came here. I was only 19. I couldn't get into any clubs, you know. And then when I met John, we could go around, hang on and, you know, go to various clubs, and that's when I started taking pictures. But I wasn't really thinking of myself as somebody who would become a photographer. When we started the artist workshop, I think I was the only member who had a camera, so it fell upon me to document our activities, our concerts, poetry readings, and then if I did come up with a good image, then we may use it on a magazine cover or a book cover, and so that's how I started.
Could you talk a little bit about the founding of the Detroit Artists Workshop, what it was all about, and why you felt like it was something that you needed to start?
Well, when you can imagine what it was like coming up in the 50s in America, you know, people were trying to break out of that middle-class, post-war, capitalist, materialistic society, and a lot of activity started all over the country. There was the civil rights movement. There was the jazz scene, which was very militant. The avant-garde jazz musicians, you know, they were very political. And the poets like Allen Ginsberg. Well, we studied everything that was going on around the country, and we were used to people from Detroit always taking off. You know, they got out of school and they went to New York or the West Coast or somewhere else to seek their fortunes, you know. We were determined to create a scene right where we were, you know, so we wouldn't have to go. And then people that had gone to San Francisco had come back to Detroit and brought back these ideas. For instance, Jerry Yunkins, who was Detroit's first hippie, I think, because he went to the West Coast in 1966 and he saw the light shows at the Avalon or what was the other one called? The Fillmore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he came back to Detroit, taught other men that it's okay to let their hair go, you know, and started the Magic Veil Light Show. Practice in the basement with other people, got the equipment together to do light shows, which eventually led to light shows at the Grandy Ballroom and concerts everywhere, you know. we had exchanges with musicians and poets in other places. You know, we didn't think of ourselves just being belonging to Detroit. I mean, we cooperated with musicians in Chicago that formed the, what's that called? The Association for the Advancement of Black Musicians or Creative Musicians or something like that. And in New York, they had an arts colony similar. In Newark, New Jersey, they're trying to do things like we did. You know, we got in a building in West Forest that we used like a community center, the Artist Workshop Community Center. And on the first floor, we had a performance space right in front of the fireplace. That's where the band played, and we had poetry readings and different exhibitions every week. Every Sunday afternoon, we got together and had a concert for people that were members or the community. It was the place to belong, to be creative, and it was very intense because the people, by us getting together on a weekly basis, people were always competing and creating something new, something to, you know, present some new music, present different bands, you know, present new poetry. And every week everybody was working to show off the next Sunday what they did, you know.
So it was, the focus was art and creativity. At what point do you feel things began to get a little bit more politically motivated?
Well, we felt it was political, you know. I mean, just promoting these avant-garde musicians, you know, they were very militant, you know. We were not political in the sense that we fell into the spectrum left, middle, right, or anything like that. You know, we considered ourselves so political, we were just outside of that whole system. At that time, we didn't really know anything about the left, the old left or the new left. We were just trying to do our own thing. You know, we got political, we got politicized after the police kept busting my husband, and then we had to get political because they were after him for political reasons, you know. So we had to fight back and organize people to do more than write poems, you know. We had to march in the streets. You know?
At what point did you start communal living in Detroit? Did you have your first commune? What led to the first commune in Detroit?
Well, the forerunner of the commune was actually the Artist Workshop Housing Project. There was a building on the large service drive, which we called the Castle. And there was one building composed of four different townhouses. Each had their own entrance, you know. And each of those townhouses had five small rooms on the second floor. And so we started taking over these townhouses one by one, and people could rent a room for $15 a month and had a communal kitchen, living room, dining room. And in the basement usually was rehearsal space for the bands. You know, there's always some drumming going on down there, you know, all through the night. And then one by one, we added another house and another house. Then for a few months after John got out of DeHoko, he was in the Detroit House of Correction for 6 months. When he got out of there, we were offered to manage the bookstore for the Fifth Estate on Plum Street, okay? And so we moved down there too. John and I had one room in the third floor above the store. But that didn't last too long. That lasted maybe 3 months. And then we moved back on the Wayne campus. And that's when we acquired an old dentist office that was on the corner of Warren and the large service drive. And below it was the committee to end the war in Vietnam and something else and something else. But we had the upstairs, and then it was John and myself, and pretty soon Pun moved in, pretty soon Jeannie moved in, pretty soon Gary moved in, pretty soon other people moved in, and every time somebody new joined us, we had to take out all the dental equipment of these little examination rooms and put it in the next room. So when the next person moved in, we had to take all that and put it in the next room until we had, I don't know, 5-6 rooms, and that's how we started living communally. Just happened that people came to live with us because we were always working on things and we needed everybody to chip in. We were all brothers and sisters, and we all partied together and worked together and tried to make a living and doing what we were doing. We worked on newspapers, we worked on the Grandy Ballroom, we started working on promoting the MC5 and all kinds of things, so the more the better. Everybody who wanted to help got a place to stay, you know, and we all cooked together and ate together, and it was cheap that way, you know. My impressions of living in the commune later on in Ann Arbor were a little bit different, because then people moved in overnight that I didn't even know, and that's how we got infiltrated by people we didn't know for a long time, and one of them was an informant. To this day, we don't know who it was. Of all the people we lived with, it could have been anybody, except I know it wasn't me. I know it wasn't John, because he was in jail. Pretty sure it wasn't my brother-in-law. But kind of everybody else, you don't know. You don't know. To this day, I might be friends with somebody who was a cop. I have no idea of knowing. Maybe a future generation of graduate students could follow up with some freedom of information inquiries and find out exactly who destroyed our good thing that we had going, you know. It was destroyed from the inside, you know. Then I had a different attitude. I had nightmares about, like, coming home after a trip to from Germany to see my family. I walk in my room and there's full of people that I don't even know. So I don't, and you can see how this infiltration has a chilling effect, because never would I want to live with the people that I don't know well, you know, just a bunch of strangers, you know. No old folks commune for me.
When you finally moved to Ann Arbor, when you left Detroit because of, you know, the police and the attention that you were getting, the unwanted attention, did you think you would be staying in Ann Arbor, that it would be your new home, or did you see it more as a transition?
I call it a strategic retreat. Sometimes when you're in a war, you have to retreat in order to save your troops, you know. That's what we did. In Detroit, we really had little chance of keeping things together because the repression was coming down real, real heavy. And the minute Coleman Young got elected in Detroit, we moved back, you know. We loved Detroit. Our hearts were in Detroit, even though some people called us traitors and said we were deserting the struggle and moving to the suburbs and all that. It wasn't the case. We had to, just to survive, we had to leave Detroit.
Can you talk a little bit about the war that was going on, about what kind of harassment you were undergoing during
those Detroit?
Days? In Detroit, yeah.
Well, there was a war going on for a long time ago against African Americans, because the police force was predominantly white. And that war was extended to the hippies. You know, hippies were just as bad as blacks, you know, and they would be stopped arbitrarily. They would be, you know, arrested and their hair cut off. And generally, hippies were, you know, there was a war against hippies. And there was a war against my ex-husband, because there was one cop in Detroit who had a personal vendetta against him, Lieutenant Stoudemire, who thought that John Sinclair was the root of all evil and that he's the one that, you know, turned all the suburban high school kids onto smoking weed. And he had a daughter who got turned onto weed, and he blamed it on us, you know. One charge after another, and the last one was possession of two joints, which put him away for 10 years. You know. That was war.
You were in a unique position when John was in jail. How did your role change, or how did you feel during that particular period of time about your life in Ann Arbor and where that was heading?
Well, we were just single-mindedly determined to get John out and change the marijuana law. So it was a 2.5-year-long struggle, actually 5.5-year-long struggle, because when he first got arrested, with the help of our lawyers, we put the trial off for about 2 years or a year and a half, something like that. And then when it finally came to trial, it was such a short notice, we were not prepared to put on a massive defense, you know. And so while John was in jail, I was just very, very busy with trying to organize things that would help get him out, you know, without a pause. You know, we did what we could. At the same time, I had two babies, and thankfully we had a whole commune of mothers and fathers who helped out with the child rearing at that time. Otherwise, hey, John might still be in jail. The reason we had a commune and the reason we had all these white panther kids walking, I mean, they were all, every one of them was necessary in order to bring this off. What we did, we needed everybody who was committed to, you know, work toward this goal.
Why, of all the places that you could have gone when you left Detroit, why did you come to Ann Arbor?
I don't think we ever contemplated any other place. Oh, yes, we did. We did go out in the country one time and found a farmhouse. It was actually really nice. There was a pond and trees and everything. It would have been perfect for the children, you know, to grow up. Somehow that fell through. I don't know why. So we did check out a place in the country, you know. But then we chose Ann Arbor. I don't really know why, but we had close relations with some people in Ann Arbor. The Stooges lived in Ann Arbor already. We had a outpost, a Translove Energies outpost in Ann Arbor, and the head of there was Michael McClatchy. He's the one that got us permits to play in West Park, and he's the one that, you know, organized things in Ann Arbor. And he's the one that we went and stayed with and who took us in and rescued us when we took too much LSD. When we just could chill out at his house for a while. Michael, he's still around.
Can you talk about David Sinclair?
There's some big shoes to fill for David Sinclair. If it wasn't for David Sinclair, his brother might still be in jail. Because after Jan was snatched up from us, we never thought he would go away. You know, we thought he would get a appeal bond and everything would go on like before, you know. Even the lawyer said, don't worry, we'll get him out on Monday, you know. And then it took 2.5 more years. But so then David Sinclair took over the business operation of the whole commune. In fact, we had to dissolve 10 Hill Street when the MC5 moved out into their own house in Hamburg. We closed down that house, and all of us, the rest of us, the Translove Energy people that were left after the MC5 moved out, we all moved en masse into 1520 Hill Street, which was Dave's commune that he had with the UP and the UP, the UP commune and the UP equipment people and you know, his tribe. So he took us in, and he, with the business manager who made sure the bills got paid, the lights stayed on, the cars got fixed, the heating oil appeared like by magic in the wintertime, the toilet paper was always there, you know. There was always food. It was Dave. Without him, I don't know. I couldn't have done it. I you know, like I said, I was very busy. Always.
Were you ever scared in Detroit or in Ann Arbor at any of these periods of time, especially having small children? Did you ever think that maybe, did you ever think, John, just keep your mouth shut about something so that we don't,
yeah,
you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, plenty of times, you know. I mean, he had a bad temper, you know. He, after the judge sentenced him to 9.5 to 10 years, he lost his temper and he yelled at the judge and says, "You're a pig, you will die." And then, you wonder why he didn't give you a peel bond. And then there was another instance during the riots. The police, the National Guard came to our apartment where we were living. And there was, Sonny was just 2 months old. I had this little baby in my arm, and John goes to the door. And he said, "No, you can't come in here. This is the free country. Where's your warrant? And if you come in here, you might as well shoot me. I don't want to live in this country if you can do this to us." He gets real mad, and I'm whimpering there and saying, "John, shut up, they have guns." So they did come in. Well, I can't blame them for coming in our apartment, because just a few days before the riots broke out, Gary Grimshaw had taken a bed sheet and had printed like a black pussycat on it. You ever see that picture? And it said, "Born baby, born." We hung it out the window, and the newspapers took pictures of it. You know? So obviously they thought we started the riots, and they came up looking in the closets for snipers. But when the riots first started, the first couple of days we had a bar. We took a TV up on the roof. We were drinking beer, watching the fires on the TV and all around us. And we thought it was just fun. Driving down Woodward, disregarding all the lights. There were no cops around. Felt good. Black and whites looting together, you know. But then it turned real ugly after a couple of days, you know. All the MC5 got arrested. They were living in this apartment, and they had a telescope out of which they watched the burning of Detroit. And the cop thought it was a machine gun nest up there. You know? They took them all. There was not enough room in the county jail or in the city jail that they housed the prisoners in the Belle Isle bathhouse. I think about that every time I go to the Belle Isle bath. This used to be full of prisoners, including the MC5. Oh, those were the bad old days. Reminiscing.
Can you talk a little bit about the founding of the White Panther Party and why it became time to solidify and pick a name and a banner to have?
Well, we were just all in love with the Black Panthers, you know. They were doing the thing that we admired. They were not a black organization. They were trying to be a political organization. They were not anti-racist. They were not a racist. They were not anti-white. But when some white radicals approached them about joining the Black Panther Party, they said, "No, I think you should organize in your own communities, because that's where the problem is. So organize white people, you know." And so we took that so to heart, you know. And when we, but when we started, you know, it was like, oh, having a lot of fun, you know, getting together and getting high and just making plans and fantasizing about what we could do. You know, we felt very powerful having this powerful band, you know, and all the MC5 were totally into it. It was the MC5 and Dan and Pun and Steve Harnadek, one of the equipment managers, and Jesse Crawford and his sidekick, Pencil White. These were two characters that came to Detroit or to Ann Arbor out of nowhere. Well, they came from Cleveland, but when they appeared, I had no idea who they were. And Jesse just became friends with the band and then became their announcer. And then he became almost the spiritual guide to the band. And they would like have long rapping sessions and talk about all kinds of things they could do in the future and just what they could do to save the world, you know, with rock and roll. And so out of those discussions was born the idea to form a White Panther Party. And it was almost tongue-in-cheek when we first started, because our first chairman was Panther White. That was his real name, the guy that came from Cleveland with Jesse. And I just found out recently why his name was Panther White. friend of his emailed me recently and said that Pansel White ran with a group of kids in high school. They all adapted names like Pansel, Tiger, all had different, you know, and his name was Pansel and his last name was White. So we made him the first chairman of the White Pansels, obviously. And, of course, the first program of the White Pansel Party is not something I can say on TV. You know, the three pinnacles of success. Okay. Anyway, that gets quoted over and over and over again for the last 30 years, 40 years. They refer to it as rock and roll, dope, and sex in the streets. Which, you know, another tongue-in-cheek. I mean, you know, we weren't going out there and having sex in the streets. So it was like a utopian ideal, you know. So anyway. And then after a while, we, I think somebody in the Black Panther Party called us psychedelic buffoons, okay? And we started getting a little bit more serious about all this, and that's when we, you know, I think then John Sinclair became chairman, and everybody got some official function. We formed the Central Committee, and the MC5 became the main group for recruiting. We made White Panther Party buttons, and anybody who put one on became a White Panther automatically, you know, was very wide open and very much like the yuppies used to do things, just, you know. There wasn't really any membership or anything. It was just an idea. And we, but then after a while, we had to get really serious about it, and we formed chapters, and every chapter had a, you know, structure, chairman, chief of staff, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Was anybody in your community turned off by the sudden, by the move towards more overt politics, the reading of Mao and the reading of Castro's speeches? Was there anyone who thought, I was here for the music and the art, I'm not interested? Or was everyone pretty much on the same page?
Everybody was on the same page back then, but when you read about it, like now, some people say, oh, I wasn't all into the politics, but, you know, you didn't say that back then, you know? So, but that became a factor after the MC5 went their own way and fired J.C. Crawford and fired John from the band, that they said, you know, they blamed it and that it was too political and that it was hindering their chance for success, you know. In fact, that's what I think was, you know, whispered in their ears by these corporate people from New York that came to help the band, you know, after John went to jail, and then they denounced John. So, part of the Cold War.
I read recently in Pun's book that we would be very self-critical, or you would analyze how effective each member's participation was and let each other know if they weren't following, you know, the rule. Did that?
That sounds more like Weatherman. Oh. We had a little bit of that, like criticism and self-criticism and, you know, ideological struggles within the Central Committee, but it wasn't like, you know, like I've read in Bill Ayers' book about how they would grill people for hours, and, you know, almost like under Stalin.
Yeah.
No, that didn't happen like that in the White Panthers. You know, we all tried and we criticized each other, but we were basically just a bunch of hippies living together trying to get our leader out of jail, you know.
But eventually you decided that you wanted to change the image. You wanted to move the image to something a little bit less militant. And can you talk a little bit about how that came to be?
I just recently came across a copy of a letter that I wrote to John when he was in jail. And this letter was in the possession of the Ann Arbor Police Department, because the jail people in Jacksonville and Marquette always made copies and sent copies around of my letters. So there was a letter that I got back through my Freedom of Information file. In this letter, it says, now that the MC5 are no longer with us, the reason for being a White Panther Party no longer exists. Something like that. But it took us another year before we actually got around to realizing it and changing the name. Because without the MC5, the name White Panther Party was misunderstood. As long as the MC5 was the image of what a White Panther was, then people could understand it's a rock and roll organization with the same goals as the Black Panthers, okay? But when the MC5 went their own way, then we floundered when we were seeking for a new name and a new image. For a while, there was a real lively discussion in letters back and forth between John and other members about naming it the Woodstock People's Party. You remember that? I talked them out of that. I went to Woodstock. Woodstock was a nightmarish experience for us, and I did not think we should adopt that image as our name. So that's how Rainbow People's Party was born. There was other suggestions. In fact, I saw a letter by Gary Grimshaw that he wrote to John where he suggested the name Rainbow Tribe or something like that. You know, he spent part of his time in San Francisco, and there it was all about tribes, you know. Tribal stomps and tribal this and tribal that. We weren't really all that into being a tribe or being a family, you know. We were a party. But there were lots of suggestions I had to change it, and eventually Rainbow People's Party won out, you know. Sounds a lot better than being white, you know.
I'm wondering about, especially during that period of time, if you were under quite a bit of pressure to keep things going, because between you and David, you were sort of keeping things going, and a lot of other people, I mean, John was in jail and Pun was running away and then in jail, and, you know, people kept getting arrested, and you two sort of had to be the rocks of the entire organization. Did you feel that pressure that you were the ones who had to keep this going if you were ever going to make progress? And
no, we felt we were all of us in it together. It was without all those 27 other people, David and I could not have kept anything together, you know. No, with everybody, and not just the people that lived with us, because we had the support of the Ann Arbor street people, you know, the street people, the hippies, the runaways, you know, the flower children, you know. But then I had a lot of help. We had a lot of help, too, from John's parents. They were very supportive, and they helped me with bringing up the children by taking them off my hands every other weekend at least, you know, and taking them away when I had things to do, and helping us out financially, you know.
When you look back on that time, you seem to have very fond memories of those days. I'm wondering, when you look back, if you see that there was anything you'd do differently if you had an opportunity to go back and try to make that life work again.
History is what it is. You know, it is what it is. I don't know what we could have done differently to change the course of history, you know. Perhaps if we had not gotten involved in the CIA conspiracy, maybe things would have turned out differently, you know, because the winds of change were in the air and the marijuana laws were bound to be changed sooner or later. We just had to keep on all fronts. We kept pushing on the legislative front. We kept pushing on the judicial, the lawyers and the judges, and we kept pushing on the what's the third branch of government?
Executive, legislative, judicial.
Well, we had to do it all. We did demonstrations in Lansing. We did demonstrations at every time John had an appearance in federal court. We had a contingent of people. We had benefit after benefit almost on a weekly basis. I don't really know what I could have done differently except not married my husband. But God only knows whom I would have married.
Where did the idea for the rally come from?
I don't know who came up with the idea, actually, but at the time, Pete Andrews was in charge of the events program at U of M, and he could rent Chrysler Arena or any space for us to have benefits, and he must have gotten together with Dave and other people because I wasn't there from the beginning, how it all came about. But we were starting to get a little desperate. It's been 2.5 years, and we did everything we could, and John is still being denied appeal bond. So we decided to do one big push and have a rally at Chrysler Arena with all Michigan bands. The headliner was supposed to be Bob Seger. And then ticket sales were real slow. We were all scared we were going to lose our butts on this one, you know, until John Lennon decided to come. And everything changed overnight, you know. But it was supposed to be a rally. Before John Lennon came on board, there was supposed to be a rally at Chrysler Arena with all Michigan talent. And if John Lennon hadn't showed up and Bob Seger was the headliner with Teagarden and Van Winkle, and John got out 3 days later, you know, Bob Seger might be the one that's dead now. Who knows? You know, I mean, I just feel John Lennon became a martyr because of us, you know. Because the government wasn't after him until after he played that benefit for John Sinclair, you know. That's when his harassment started. And then he was, he and Yoko were ordered deported to England, and they were allowed to stay in this country under the condition that they don't engage in any political activity. Now, if you were Lennon, John Lennon, the working class hero, I wonder, you know, you can imagine what that did to his soul and his psyche. Here he seeks freedom in the land of the free, you know. When they first moved to New York, John and Yoko were able to walk down the street holding hands through the village, and nobody bothered them. There was no hordes of teenagers chasing them out, you know. And so they enjoyed living in New York, where they had relatively freedom to be normal people. You know? And then for the government and J. Edgar Hoover and Richard Nixon and all these people telling him he couldn't be himself anymore, you know. That's like a death sentence right there. You know? I think he gave his life for a cause, you know. That's my feeling.
Regarding John Lennon, did John Lennon approach you? Because he learned about John's predicament from Jerry Rubin, isn't that right? And then did John approach you and say that this was something he wanted to do, or?
No, I think he told Jerry Rubin, and Jerry Rubin told us. Okay, first he wrote that song about John, and then, you know, I don't know if he knew about the rally before he wrote the song or after that, I don't know.
What was the actual rally like? Was it just incredibly hectic?
For me, it was. For me, I didn't really have any time to enjoy the bands because I was trying to coordinate our literature table where we were trying to sell some posters and some programs to make a little money back. And I had the two children to watch over. And once in a while, I got to run downstairs in front of the stage and snap a few pictures, and then I had to go back to work. And so I did get a couple pictures of John and Yoko. I got a couple pictures of Bob Seger and Teagarden and Van Winkle. I got a couple pictures of Archie Shepp with Charles Moore. And I think that's all. The rest of the time, I was just too busy.
But 3 days later, John's released. Can you talk to us about how that felt? What is your lasting memory of that particular event?
Euphoria. Euphoria. and a whirlwind of activity following, like the day after he got out. We barely had time to get to know each other and breathe together. That we were called to New York to hobnob with the Lennons and to, go on whirlwind speaking tours, do interviews on TV with Bill Barnes and all kinds of stuff. And so there was never any time to reflect and go back to who we were before he got snatched away, with all of a sudden it was just like we were like in this whirlwind that kept on getting, going along, and we just went along. That started our alienation, that John all of a sudden was a celebrity, and I felt silly sometimes, going to places where he was giving a speech and I was just standing next to him or behind him, like the little woman behind the big man. That's where I felt, a division came in between me and John. It's like that we never had really had a chance to reconnect and become a family again, Then our lives just played themselves out in the media, So. And while John was in jail, he was everybody's favorite political prisoner, and then after he came out, things turned out a little differently when John was trying to resume his normal life again and manage bands and put on concerts. There was a real backlash from the left. The people that formerly worshipped him now turned against him and called him a hip capitalist who is a traitor to the movement now because he charges money to get into events and stuff. And the White Panther Party program says everything free for everybody. So there was a backlash against him that he did not really comprehend where that came from. Well, I have my own theories, and that's another topic for some graduate students to research sometime. Where did that backlash come from? My theory is that it came from the most militant factions in Ann Arbor that were actually fronts for the counterinsurgency. One of them was the Gay Rights Liberation Front. I don't know if you know anything about that. These were a group of people that were so anti-male white that their program was that unless you're gay or bisexual, you're counter-revolutionary. So, and they called John a male chauvinist pig, and they spray-painted slogans on U of M campus that said, "Free Lenny Sinclair." And those kinds of things were so hurtful that I think to this day, just John doesn't understand that I feel there was an orchestrated a campaign to damage him and our relationship, because what's worse than a radical with money? And so they tried to do whatever they could to make it impossible for John to get a foothold again in the music business, He suffers from to this day, He's tried managing bands and he's tried this and that, and most of it just never produced any money, So that, I think, was the long-lasting effect of what they did. They destroyed it. They destroyed us,
Did you feel they had that was part of what caused the end of the Ann Arbor Jazz and Blues Festival as well?
Oh, yeah. That and the demise of the Human Rights Party, which was also caused by infiltrators, In the early 90s, I had a job working for the Detroit Police Red Squad distribution program. It was a program that was mandated by the courts to right the wrongs that were done by the Detroit Police Red Squad when they, had surveillance on people for political purposes, not for criminal purposes. So I was in charge, or I was one of the researchers who was in charge of amassing files for people that asked for their files back, and they had to be censored by the police and everything. But I learned a whole lot about how the police and how the infiltrators and how the agent provocateurs work. And when you go back in history and research what happened to organizations that had a progressive program, invariably there's a split and they fight each other instead of working together. You know, I mean, it's always under capitalism, divide and conquer. As long as it's black against white, they leave you alone, you know. Like Malcolm X was no threat to them until he started talking about, it's not about race, it's about class. Same with Martin Luther King. When he started talking about the poor people's march and not the black people's march, that's when he got killed, you know. And I think the same thing happened with the women's liberation movement, which was infiltrated, which was directed and financed by the CIA in order to put a division between men and women and destroy the, any kind of chance of a movement they had working together. To me, the women's liberation movement was always misdirected from the start, in my opinion, because it should have been a mother's liberation movement. It should have been mothers and others, not females against males, you know. But it didn't happen. Look at the Black Panther Party and how they destroyed them. They put Eldridge Cleaver against U.P. Newton. It's the COINTEL program that did that. You know, they wrote letters, like there was a letter from Eldridge Cleaver to U.P. Newton, but it wasn't written by Eldridge, it was written by the CIA. Same thing happened to the White Panther Party. They published a letter in the New York Times and made all the papers in the country saying, White Panthers plan to kidnap Spiro Agnew to demand freedom for Jan Sinclair. It was the agent who wrote the letter. And this campaign against us was designed to paint us as a violent, dangerous organization prior to the CIA wiretap case. They were trying to influence the judges to vote in favor of Nixon having all these new powers. They were trying to institute the Patriot Act in 1971, you know. And we put a stop to it. So anyway, but we know freedom isn't free. We paid the price, you know.
When you left Ann Arbor to go to Detroit, what was the spirit of that move? Was there a spirit of defeat that something had failed, or were you excited to be going back to Detroit? Did you feel that a new day was dawning in Detroit?
Oh, no. It was an escape from Ann Arbor, the same it was when we went from Detroit to Ann Arbor. When we left Ann Arbor, we were so down and out that we had to go begging for food. At the same time, the city councilman, there was one real ferocious right-wing city councilman who was raging, saying, Sinclair made $1 million and now he's leaving town. And they had no idea that we were on our last straw financially. We couldn't hold that house together. We couldn't keep nothing together. We were way, way, way over debt. My brother-in-law, David Sinclair, bless his heart, he stayed in Ann Arbor for 10 more years working his ass off and paid off every penny we ever bought. You know, there was conflict between him and his father over that issue too, you know.
After that, what did you do when you got back to Detroit? Can you tell us about your life following your return to Detroit?
Yeah, we were still a commune. We were still five people of us. We were like the last, you know, hold overs from the commune days, and it was John, myself, and Frank Park, and Peggy Buck, and Barbara Weinberg, and we rented a house in Detroit. And we tried to just work to survive. John started working with Charles Morgan, who was in the artist workshop, and they had started a record company by then called Strato Records. which we worked for, and then Barbara Weinberg and her husband David Fenton kind of shifted the Ann Arbor Sun to Detroit, and it became the Detroit Sun, and we all worked for the Sun. I was production manager, which meant I never slept. Mm-hmm. And just trying to pick up where we left off before we left, you know, trying to get back into the music business and doing what we were supposed to do before they made it out. So coming back to Detroit was very difficult. We had absolutely no money. We were just really down and out and had to work our way back. But under those, you know, under those circumstances, our marriage did not survive. You know, economic hardship can do that to a marriage, you know. When you have no chance of things ever getting any better, you just take it out on each other and it just doesn't work. But at the same time, you know, being back in Detroit, at least it felt like we were back on our own territory, in our own home, because when you live in a city like Ann Arbor and you're poor, but it's hard, you know, when you live in Detroit and you say you have no money, people know that means you have no money. In Ann Arbor, somebody says, "I have no money." Well, you didn't get to the ATM, you know. So anyway, Detroit, you know, when you're poor and live among other poor people, it's more fun, you know, than living poor and being in a town where everybody thinks you're rich. That stress is stressful.
So you said you never set out to be a photographer. When did you start identifying yourself as a photographer? When did you say, this is what I do, I'm a photographer?
I still don't. I started in the artist workshop, you know, when our program was at. When you think of yourself as an artist, then the rest of life gets put into a perspective that it doesn't get you down when you have to do this for a living or that for a living, as long as you think you're doing that in order to work in your profession, you know, that keeps you going. So at the artist workshop, I started thinking of myself as an artist, and my art was photography. I did an exhibition, you know, I made some nice prints. I loved working in the dark room, you know. I still do, but now it's almost a lost pleasure. I don't have time for my beloved dark room work anymore. It's all like computers now, you know. I don't really like that. But so, you know, when I got my camera, I never thought of becoming a photographer. That just happened by default because I was the person with the camera, so I got to take the pictures, you know. Same as when we, you know, managed the MC5. I had a camera, so I constantly was taking pictures to use for publicity to help them become more famous, you know.
Do you have a favorite photograph?
Yeah, I would say it's my picture of John Coltrane. I'm just so lucky I have that really beautiful picture of him. Only one. One good one, but that's all it takes sometimes, even of Jimi Hendrix. I only got one out of a whole roll of film. I only got one nice one, you know. So that's enough, you know.
What are you doing today? Can you talk about what your work is today?
I'm still a full-time mother. Now I'm also a single grandmother. You know, that's what I do mostly, try to provide and keep my family alive and from despairing. And at the same time, I'm trying to get a book published with my friend Gary Grimshaw. And it's been very hard because we've all had our problems, family problems, money problems, health problems, and we're keeping on, one page at a time. And it's called Detroit Rocks, a pictorial History of Motor City Rock and Roll, 1965 to 1975. And it consists mostly of Gary's posters and flyers and artwork, coupled with my photos that go along with it. Say, for instance, if there's a poster of Big Brother and the Holding Company, there'll be my pictures of Janis Joplin. We're putting it together like that. That's what my main occupation now is, to try to get that book finished and get it out, because I have all kinds of other plans in the pipeline and I have to make some progress before I die. I have to, you know. It wasn't for nothing I was Minister of Education. I have a mandate to educate.
Do you still keep in contact with, I mean, obviously you keep in contact with Gary Grimshaw. You're working with him on a book. Do you keep in contact with a lot of the other White Panthers, a lot of the other people from that era?
I'm still very good friends with Jeannie Plomanen, but it's something that's recent. You know, there was a whole big period of 2 or 3 decades where we had no contact. And just in the last 10 years or so, became deeper friends than ever before, you know. And same with Pun, and same with Becky Tyner, the widow of Rob Tyner, and Gary and Laura Grimshaw. And I know more about people now, about some people now, than I did back then. It seems back then we were so involved in daily activities that we never sat down and talked about your mama or your sisters or any, you know, the families didn't exist. We were the family then, you know. But now I get to know people on a more personal level, you know.
What's the thing you're proudest of?
Personally, I would think the thing that I'm most proud of is being part of that movement that helped save democracy. And that's also the main thrust of the book, that it was the Detroit rock and roll community that was instrumental. Because if it hadn't been for the support that John got locally, God only knows if they had picked, say, Weathermen, or if they had picked the Republic of New Africa as a testing group, we may very well have lost. And then all of us, including Damon Keith and John Sinclair, me, everybody, we could be in a concentration camp now. If Nixon had won, he would have had the sole power, just like you know, any dictator, to single-handedly decide who lives and dies, who goes to jail, who gets broken into, who gets detained without bail. You know, all that was in the pipeline that was coming if we hadn't won. It's what I'm most proud of as a citizen, to having been part of that, what saved us. Because when I read my files from the CIA or the FBI, there was one agent early in who surmised that maybe I was sent to America by the Stasi to recruit American college students to becoming little commies. And what better way than to marry one of the student leaders in America, John Sinclair?
How clever of you. Oh, how cunning you were.
See what I mean? And so in retrospect, I want to tell this agent, well, perhaps I was sent to America by a higher force, by a higher power than that, to do my little part in keeping America safe for democracy for another generation. I'm an American. I believe that the American character, and most Americans are good people, compassionate people, love their freedom. Some of them are brainwashed and seeking it in the wrong places, you know. But basically, I don't believe, you know, as a German, I don't believe what happened in Germany could happen here, because Americans are not like Germans. Americans are not as obedient, as well, maybe so, but I don't know. I might be taking my foot in my mouth here, you know. But I have hope for the future that, you know, that America will survive as a democratic nation, you know, and that people in Egypt and other places, you know, they look towards the United States as a inspiration for their own struggle.
To learn more about Lenny Sinclair, go to freeingjohnsinclair.org.
AADL Talks to Lenny Sinclair has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.